Not as April 22nd, 1995. And I'm Kathy Denton, and I'm interviewing my mother, Esther Cummings, to find out about her interesting life and all the great stories she's been telling us our whole life. So, Mom, tell me about your grandparents.
My grandparents. Well, as I remember it, I was about 7 years old, I think, when my grandfather was a worked shoeing horses. What do you call them? I've forgotten already. Blacksmith.
Yeah.
And he got awfully sick, and then at the same day, my grandmother got awfully sick. And the two of them suffered for several months. And finally, they put them in separate bedrooms, and they went into, they saw grandmother had died. And they went into granddad, and they said, she's comfortable, she's resting.
Okay. You only missed the last couple ones.
Okay. Grandmother had died, and they went in to see what they needed to do for Granddad. And he asked, how's Ida? And he said, she's resting comfortably. And he said, what do you tell me that for? There she is. He pointed up toward the ceiling. He says, there she is. Ida, Ida, wait for me. And he died, smiling.
Died so what were their names, their full names?
Hers was Ida. I don't remember his first name. Ida Leach. His last name was Leach. I can't remember his first name. But all I remember, I dream about their old house. I lived in it when I was a senior in high school. I lived in it all year.
Where was it at?
In Francisville, Indiana. And I used to go to the Pulaski High School, but my senior year, my dad worked at the Jasper Pulaski Game Preserve, and they wanted me to go to Francisville where I could get more courses so I could get into Purdue. And, I stayed with the people that were renting my grandmother's house the whole winter while I was at Francisville, and I graduated from Francisville High School. I don't remember much else about it. That was just it. But I did get in. I couldn't go to Purdue the next year. Nellie Jo and Owen were both in college, and I had to wait for one of them to get out at least before I could go. So I had to stay home that winter and help with the farm work. And the sheep were mine, and the cattle. I did the milking. And of course, there were horses and pigs and chickens. But then in 19...
Turn it over?
You sure it's taken now?
Yeah. Okay. I can see the wheel turning when it's working.
In 1941, I went to Purdue. And then on December the 7th, we were having breakfast, getting ready to go to church. It was a Sunday. And we heard this announcement on the radio that Pearl Harbor was being bombed. And people around the room said, oh, that can't be. It's another one of those stories put out. Now, that name slipped me too. There was a man that was putting out wild stories from the outer space.
Orson Welles,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's just another Orson Welles story. Nobody believed it. And we went on to church, hoping it wasn't true. Then the next day, we went to a German class. And, of course, later on on Sunday afternoon, we heard President Roosevelt's announcement. And the day that would be remembered in infamy. And then on Monday, when we went to class, I went to my German class, and the professor was looking around the students. Some of them were advanced military in uniform because they had their military exercises afterwards. And he says, I will not have anybody in uniform in my class. So the boys obediently left. But a little bit later, the dean of men came in and says, Mister, we'll take you. And that was the last we saw of him. We don't know if he got shipped out of the country or what, but the German professor was no more, and that was the end of my learning German. And that was the beginning of the Second World War. I was a freshman at Purdue University. Now, went on through, I was there for 3.5 years, and during that time, the soldiers were marching, the advanced military were all made officers and sent overseas immediately. And campus had marching soldiers and sailors who were taking classes there all the time. So that made university life a little bit different than the average. And what else do you want to know about it?
Oh, I want to know about, tell me about your parents.
My parents, my father was a civil engineer. He had laid out the Union Pacific Railroad, and Evelyn and his first wife to California while he was doing it. Evelyn was 5 years old, and when her mother died in California of TB.
What were your parents' full names?
Clarence Evans Hall and Bessie Leach. Leach was her maiden name. Paul, of course. When Dad was coming back with Evelyn with him, he was telling everybody Evelyn was 5 years old. They had been in California 3 years. And while they were there, they'd had a big earthquake. So I grew up hearing Dad say that California's going to fall off the map someday. And then coming back from California, there was this school teacher who was coming from Oregon. And she took an interest, of course, in Evelyn, who needed a woman to take care of her at times, and asked how old she was, and Dad said 5. Oh, boy, she's big for a 5-year-old. And of course, she didn't tell him that, but she took care of her all that trip across the nation, and it took a while in those days, even on a train. And finally, every station they'd stop at, they'd say goodbye and didn't expect to see each other again, get back on the train, and lo and behold, there they were, both of them going on. Finally, they got to Francisville, and there again, they said goodbye. And Dad headed out in the country, and Mom stopped in Francisville, Indiana, where her folks were. And from then on, it was 12 miles from Francisville to the farm. And when Dad went courting her, he'd get on a horse and wagon and drive into Francisville, the 12 miles, and visited with her as long as he liked. When he started home, he'd just hitch up the horse, give him his head, climb in the back, and go to sleep in the wagon. Wake up in the morning in the barnyard. And you can't do that with a car. So I thought that was a pretty good part of the story. What other kind do you want?
Let's see. Tell me how many brothers and sisters you had and what all their names were.
Well, Evelyn was the one they brought back from California. Evelyn, what was her middle name? I don't remember. My own sister, and I don't remember middle name. Well, she was the oldest, of course. And then after Mom and Dad got married, they got Lester Hibbard, who was named after both his grandparents. And Hibbard was my great-grandfather's name. He was the one that came from Wales. And Lester was my mother's father's name. I remember now, that's where he got the Lester. And let's see, Lester's name, Arthur Norman, was the second one. And as of this date, you got the day, I guess, Les is still living but he's terribly, terribly sick. I haven't heard from him for months. And Arthur died. You remember when Tom was born? You know, his funeral was the day Tom was born.
My Tom?
Yeah.
November 21st of 1981.
So, did it get on there?
I don't know.
November 21st, 1981 was when Kathy's little Tom was born. And that was the day of Arthur's funeral. Nella Jo was next. And he married a Marine lawyer. And then after the war, Mel retired, but Nella Jo went into tour guiding in Washington, D.C. And they had visited every country in the world. Nellie's got charm bracelets, which includes every country she was ever in, and they had seen them all. And then her children later on would travel back and forth to see their old friends in some of those different countries just for the fun of it. So it wasn't a matter of visiting a neighbor across the street. What a family, boy. I couldn't have done it. I'm not that kind. I just couldn't have done it. But I've always admired her greatly. She was so beautiful. Nellie Jo. Now next was Owen Arnold Paul. He was 2 years older than I. And he became a professor at Purdue University. And he was grading papers one night late. And the next morning, his wife Mary went down to get him for breakfast. And she said he was smiling at something in the corner. Very beautiful expression on his face. His left hand was picking up a paper and his right hand had laid down one. And Mary spoke to him. He said nothing. So she tapped him on the shoulder and he fell out of the chair. He was dead. I want to see what he saw when he was called to heaven. That's why I'm anxious to go. And let's see, I'll be 73 next May, if I make it. May 24, can you imagine? I want you all to remember that birthday. what else do you want to know now?
Tell me about Dad.
Oh, your dad, yeah. Oh, he was a brilliant man. Oh, he was really brilliant. He was 175 IQ with a total recall.
Alfred G. Cummings?
Alfred Glenn Cummings. Yeah, we called him Glenn. His mother called him Alfred. His friends all called him Al. But I don't know why he wanted to be called Glenn when he introduced himself to me. It was Glenn, and so he was always Glenn to me. And he was a chemical engineer. And after he, well, he served in the Second World War, Patton's 11th Armored. And he went in, let's see, he went in overseas in January 1943, and he was over there 18 months. And he was a reconnaissance officer, and he saw Dachau, where a lot of the Jews were murdered by the Germans. And as a reconnaissance officer, he was always 5 miles ahead of the army to tell them where the enemy was and where to shoot. And if the numbers were wrong or if the directions were taken wrong, he was a target. But he managed to live through it. And he told me he was never injured. But he did come back shell-shocked. And he returned June 28th. I got two calls, one from New York and one from the farm in Pulaski County, Indiana. Both at the same time, the same instant. And he said, well, who do we tell you first, then. Somebody said to your, her father, because Dad had died, and they, then I got to talk to Glenn. He had just landed in New York, and I told him Dad had died. It was a good thing they told me Dad first, because then he got off immediately to come straight home. Otherwise, he would have had to take 2 or 3 weeks in getting going through all kinds of customs and health examinations and everything else before they put him in the States. As it was, they let him come home immediately, so he was there in time for the funeral.
Tell me the story about the car keys.
Car keys?
Yeah, about when you were in, I think you were in Purdue, and you went to some party.
Oh, that was after we graduated, after your father. After the war, he went back to Purdue, and we got a little house trailer, 15 feet long, which was our first home. We had been married in 1943, December 18th, 1943, we were married. 1 year later to the day, he went overseas. And so after he got back from the service and got discharged honorably, we bought this little house trailer thing. Art had owned it, and he sold it to us for practically nothing, so Glenn could get back into university and finish getting his degree. And, of course, I had to have appendicitis a month before school started, and the doctors wouldn't let me go back to school. I had hoped to finish my degree then, but I couldn't go back because my health doctor said I couldn't. So, in a month or two, when I was feeling better, I got a job at the Department of Agriculture and worked in the rat lab. Then a couple of the students who were finishing to get their degrees as veterinarians had heard that I'd had all that time at school, and they thought I should help them. So I did their routine work and their reports, and did a lot of tests and things. And I think I learned more working for them than I would have if I'd taken classes. However, it didn't get me a degree. So Glenn got his degree, and while he was going up the aisle to get his diploma, I had to run for the bathroom. I was pregnant and very sick. So his first son, Glenn Paul, was born on November 15th, the next year. He graduated the spring of, what was it? When was it? 1947. And then Gilbert was born in 49. Trina was born in 53. Ann was born in 54. Teresa was born in 55. Tom was born in 50. No, I lost a year there somewhere. Well, I had lost a child in between Teresa and Tom. So there was more than a year between those. And Tom was born in 48. 58. And Kathy was born in 59.
But I never heard the story about the car keys.
Ah, those car keys. Well, your ever-loving father got a job working for Firestone. And it was at Cleveland, Ohio. And we had a company party for Christmas. And of course, everybody got very, very happy. And at the end of the party, the girls, women, wives, were lined up in a big circle. There must have been, I forget, around 35 couples there. And the women were all in this big circle, practically touching elbow to elbow. And the husbands threw their car keys in the center. The wives were blindfolded and told to crawl to the center of the room and get a set of car keys and go home with anybody whose keys they got. Well, my dear husband, bless his heart, he held back. He was the last to throw his keys in. And everybody, of course, was holding their breath, waiting for him. He turned around to me, gave me a great big, I guess you'd call it a military bow, handed me his keys, and we marched out. And every woman in the place came to me weeks afterwards, "How on earth did you get him to do that?" And I said, "I had no idea he was going to." But at least I got to go home with my husband, who was so excited about the whole thing. As we were driving out the gate after that party, he hit a policeman.
Yeah, I told you that when you forgot.
I didn't remember that part.
Oh, well, you weren't with us.
Did he live?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it just kind of turned him around. The crowd leaving those parties from that place, it was in Kentucky, across the river from Cincinnati, was where the party was. And the crowd was so thick, and all those cars trying to press on to the one road that took them across the river, the Ohio, back to Cincinnati. It was so crowded, they had to have the police direct the traffic. And Glenn just did not see that man. And he didn't knock him down. He just kind of turned him around. And of course he stopped, and the policeman was so busy, he says, "Oh, get out of here." So he didn't get a ticket for it. But he was a little more than upset about that car key business. After any company party we went to after that, we left before the party was over. He wasn't going to take another chance getting caught in something like that.
Back up a little bit, because I want to hear the story of, I think you were 8 years old and a farmhouse burned down.
Oh, when our farmhouse burned down, I was in the eighth grade.
Oh.
That's more than 8 years old. And I was coming home. White Oak School was, a mile or 2 miles through the woods, over the meadow and through the woods to grandmother's house we go, if you're coming home from the school. Anyway, I was coming home, and neighbors came driving through the pasture. And, of course, we owned those 280 acres, and nobody's supposed to drive in somebody else's farm without permission. So they came driving up behind me, and I didn't know what to do about it. And they told me to get in the car, and I said, "No, sir, I wanted to walk home. I had to take the sheep and cattle home." And they said, "Get in the car, the house is burning down." I looked up over the trees, and sure enough, there was that huge, big black cloud. So I got in the car, and we went to home. And the house was pretty well gone, and there was some furniture around. Some men had carried out that huge piano. Only took two men to carry it out, but it took six to take it back in after they got the house built. And I went hunting for my mother. I couldn't find her, and I began yelling around, "Who's seen Mom?" And they told me she was down in the garden. And I found her down in the garden, and she was crying her heart out. Well, she hadn't been able to rescue my doll. Everything else in that house, we lost a lot, but that doll was the thing she was crying about. She wanted to know about it. Well, the thing I thought was so outstanding, the Catholics and Protestants fought tooth and nail almost all the time. They just wouldn't be seen speaking to each other. But with the telephones like they were on the farm, you ring the old phone, and you're likely to get anybody. Everybody in the county was on the line. You ring that three times, they knew it was a warning. Something bad had happened. My mother had rung it in. She only had to ring once. Said, the house is on fire, halt. And right away, all the neighbors from, 2 to 8, 10 miles away came running to help. So that was the advantage of the farm situation, that the neighbors did help each other, and the Catholics and Protestants worked together. And then after the fire, it was in the spring, and all those farmers got together and helped put in all the crops. And then later on, when it came to building the house, they helped build the house. And we all learned to work together because of that fire. Blessings to them.
Okay. Accident. Did Rich, where Dad worked? Or...
Oh, we were living in Charleston, West Virginia. Charleston was where the chemical plant was, a little village on the outside of Charleston called Nitro. It was appropriate. And the Goodrich plant, where Glenn worked, was next door to a Monsanto plant. And we lived 12 miles in St. Albans on top of the hill. Glenn and Gail were 2 and 4 years old, and they came running in, and Glenn, the father, was taking a bath, and they ran in there, Dad, something's on fire down where you work. And he says, oh, don't bother me, I want to get my bath. And I said, no, it's on fire, run, look. And the house was on this hilltop, and we could see all the way into Charleston. And certainly, from 12 miles, you couldn't tell whether it was Goodrich or Monsanto that was burning. So Glenn jumped into his pants and yelled down, as he ran down the stairs, he yelled at me to call him, tell him not to put water on it. And of course I couldn't get through. But Glenn had always carried safety equipment in the car, gas masks and different kinds of things that would be needed in such a case. So he did have some safety equipment, and he fought that fire all night. Since he was so close to it, he found out it was Monsanto and not Goodrich. But he knew, fighting that fire, that it was lethal, very, very deadly. He came home the next morning. I had his breakfast ready, and I thought he'd go to bed and get some sleep. He ran in the boys' room, started throwing their clothes in suitcases, and he said, if that wind changes, their lives aren't worth 2 cents. And we threw together everything we could that we could think of that we'd have to take in a minute, and left. I started up to Cleveland from West Virginia. He drove all day after fighting that fire to get those boys away from the possibility of that smoke from that fire getting to them. But that day, he knew he would not live much longer. And everybody that was in 5 miles radius of that fire died within 5 years. And the nation buried it. They would not let it be known. And that's why I couldn't get any insurance from the company. And I had to raise my 7 children alone for 20 years on Social Security. Thank God for Social Security at the time.
When was it that fire occurred again?
I can't remember the exact date. We even figured out. Glenn was 4 and Gilbert was 2. Okay. Glenn's 45 now. No, Glenn's 48 now. So 4 years off, 48.
44 years ago.
44 years ago, 44 years off of 95.
51.
1951. Yeah. What?
Yeah, I guess so. Oh, tell me the one where trees broke out.
Oh, well, Glenn would come home from work. We had a brand new Ford. I can see it, but I can't describe it. And he was very proud of that car. And every night when he'd come home, Teresa would run out on the back porch and jump into his arms. And they made quite a game of it. And then one night Glenn came home, and the neighbor next door had something he had to know right away, and he was yelling at Glenn. Glenn was looking at him and didn't see Teresa jump. And when she jumped, he just got hold of one arm, and it broke her shoulder. And the